All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, world, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. United States Army, 1967, holy mackerel, 1967 and 1971. Helicopter pilot with the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. Want to welcome you to Veterans Radio today. We're going to be talking about a lot of things. I've got a couple of events that we want to talk to. And then we're going to be talking about Korea and the Korean War with a Korean War veteran. And he's not only going to tell us about his experiences in Korea, but he's also got a few opinions about maybe what we should be doing with Korea in the future. As we know, that Korea has been on the minds of many people in the last couple of months, and so we'll probably be talking about that, I am sure. So you got to make sure that you stick around and listen to that. Leonard Edrian is the author of the book. He is also the Korean veteran. He was a medic over there. You have to admire those guys. I don't know how they did that day in and day out, but that's what he's going to be talking about. He's got a new book out called Hilltop Doc, and that's going to be the topic after we take a quick break. But let's talk about a couple of announcements that come up. Remember, if you have anything that you want us to talk about here on Veterans Radio, you just need to contact us. Go to the veteransradio.net website, click on Contact Us. If you have an event, we'll announce the event. If you've got a story idea, we'll explore it and see if we can bring you on the program. So make sure that you do that. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can do all kinds of things with all the social media that is out there. If you go to our website, you'll see that we have podcasts of different things that we haven't talked about on the air here at Veterans Radio, but also the archives of probably the vast majority of our almost 600 programs. I think that's pretty cool considering we've been on the air since 2003. All right, here's a question for you history buffs out there. What happened on August 2nd, 1776? Beep. No sound. Okay. Well, August 2nd happens to be the anniversary of our founder's greatest high crimes and treason against the crown. That was when the declaration was formally signed in the version that we all come to know and love. And there's a party going on, actually. It's a come join the 13th celebration of liberty on August 4th. That's next Friday. As we celebrate liberty, independence, and, of course, the high crimes and treasons against the crown, this is sponsored by the 13th Michigan Congressional District Republicans. They will also be collecting school supplies for local students as we get ready to send the kids back to school. The evening includes a strolling dinner, open bar, karaoke, silent auction, ice cream bar, and plenty of fun. Tickets are $35 a person or only $30 if you bring a school supply. Scholarships are available, and our sponsors will be recognized at the event. Okay, that's the what. Here's the where. It's Stefan's Banquets at St. Michael's Cultural Center on West Chicago in Redford, Michigan. It is on Friday, August 4th, 2017, from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. If you want more information, just type in on your browser, 13th Congressional District Republicans Committee. I know that sounds like a lot, right? But or you can go to MatthewXHauser.com, and he's got more information for you there. So that's coming up on Friday, and this is the 13th Michigan Congressional District Republicans, a celebration of liberty, the anniversary of the actual signing of our Declaration of Independence. Sounds like it might be kind of fun. So check that out. Another event that's coming up, you know, one of the facilities that we have here in our local area is the Yankee Air Museum. And we know that the Yankee Air Museum is coming up with their Thunder over Michigan over Labor Day weekend. That's the 2nd through 4th of September. And let me tell you just a few things that are going to be available at that for all you airplane buffs or history buffs or just military buffs. It's something that I think that you may want to go to. The main attraction this year is the United States Navy Blue Angels, and I have seen them perform a number of times, and it's just more thrilling every time I see them. You cannot believe that a jet plane going at 600 miles an hour can get that close to each other, upside down, almost with the cockpits looking at you. It's It's phenomenal what they can do. They're the main attraction, but there are many, many more things that are going on at Thunder Over Michigan this year. We've got the Navy C-130 Fat Albert, which is a supply plane for the Blue Angels. It's a big blue and gray support aircraft. It's kind of cool, and I think you'd like to see that. There are aircraft rides available on the B-17, on the B-25, on a C-47, or Wacko biplane. Hey, you can book a ride on any of the Yankee Airplane's historical flying aircraft and experience what it was like to be a military pilot. I would strongly suggest save up your pennies for these rides, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you to take rides in these really fantastic aircraft. There's going to be World War II reenactments. There's going to be other jets or static displays. There's going to be a Yonkin Twin Beach airplane. Matt Yonkin is an incredible stunt pilot, I guess you would call him. I don't want to degrade him at all, but he can do things with this Beach 18 airplane that you can't believe. He does barrel rolls, in and side out rolls, number eights, stalls, everything else that he can think of. So take an opportunity to check that out. And then, of course, there's a Shelton aircraft is going to be there as well. Lots and lots of things for you to do. Again, that's on from September 2nd through September 4th at the Yankee Air Museum. For more information on that, just go to yankeeairmuseum.org. Coming up this Wednesday at the Yankee Air Museum, you know, they've been having these really great presentations, historic presentation nights is what they call it. And coming up on this Wednesday, August 2nd, is Escape and Evasion in Europe, an Airman's World War II Odyssey in the Shadows. And it's a presentation by Warren Kara. His father had been captured during World War II. And for training to shoot down, they're rescued by the French underground and much more. This is much likely to be a compelling personal wartime narrative you'll ever hear. It says that the three Luftwaffe fighters had just destroyed his B-17, and in the last moments before the final dive, the supporting crew, including pilot John Carroll, were about to jump. So begins the harrowing story of a young kid from Northern California who finds himself alone behind enemy lines in 1943. This is something you need to do and go to see this. So I would strongly suggest that you do this. This is coming up on Wednesday evening at the Yankee Air Museum, which is on the east side of West Willow Run Airport on D Street. It begins at 7:30. It's absolutely free, plus you get to go through the displays. So check it out when you get the opportunity. All right. I think that's all for all those things for right now. And so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, joining us on the air will be the author of the new book, Hilltop Doc, and that is Leonard Adrian, and he was a medic during Korea, and he's going to talk a lot about, I hope, about what he experienced during his tour in Korea and what he thinks we should be doing over there next time. So we'll be right back after this quick break. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We are back on Veterans Radio, and today's topic is we're going to be talking about Korea. And as we know, Korea has been in the news recently because they have the capability now, it appears, that to be able to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles with the possible range of reaching the west coast of America and even further. And so there's some issues going on there. In fact, even today in the news, I was reading a story that we decided that we'd show them a little display, I guess you could say, of power, and two B-1 bombers escorted by South Korean jets flew low level over the South Korean capital. And of course, you can see that from Pyongyang. And I hope it sends a message. And I'm hoping that as we get into our conversation today, we can find out more and more about what is going on in Korea. But let's go back about a long time, right? Joining me on Veterans Radio today is Leonard Adrian. And Leonard was 60 years ago, he was in the Korean War, and he didn't tell anybody about it, never talked about it at all. And I think the issue is becoming more and more important to address. Many people regard the Korean War as a forgotten war, and we do everything we can here at Veterans Radio to make sure that people don't forget it. So I'm going to bring Leonard on right now. So, Leonard Adrian, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm sure you are. I'm really glad that you're here. So tell me about how you got to Korea in the first place.
I was in the Navy during World War II. Excuse me, I'm having a little voice problem. And I was discharged when the war ended in 1945. I joined the Navy Reserve, thinking that was a smart thing to do. Turned out to be not so smart.
Right.
Because they said that they could pay me about $8 to go to a meeting on a Wednesday night or something like that. And my dad told me that if you have a chance to get a buck, grab it, because we grew up in the Depression and we had no money. So here I joined the Navy. Got out of the Navy. The GI Bill allowed me to go to Washington University in St. Louis. Graduated in June of 1950. And, of course, on June 25th of 1950, the Korean War began, and I was invited back into the service.
Oh, that six-year reserve time schedule, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was called back, and I was eventually assigned to the 1st Marine Division at my pre-Korean training in Camp Pendleton, in California. Got on a ship with 5,500 other Marines, and we arrived in Busan, and they helicoptered us to the 38th parallel, where I was stationed during almost all of my time on that peninsula.
So for our own audience's sake, the 38th parallel was the dividing line between North and South. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. And did you arrive after the Chinese had gotten involved or before?
No, I arrived after the Chinese gotten involved. The Chinese crossed the Yellow River, hundreds of thousands of them crossed the Yellow River in November of 19... I arrived in the early spring of 1951, so the Chinese had already been involved and were involved. And in fact, by the time I got there, we were fighting Chinese. We were not fighting North Koreans anymore.
Okay. And can you describe what your job was there?
Yeah, I was a corpsman, which is my responsibility was to give medical aid to the wounded Marines in my outfit. So yes, that was my job.
Wow. And did you have any medical background at all?
No, not really. I was in the Navy when I was drafted. I went to Great Lakes. They showed us a film, and the film showed all the jobs in the Navy, and I picked the job of a rographer's mate, which is a guy that sits on an aircraft carrier and predicts weather for the pilots. I thought that was challenging and interesting to me. They came back and said, "You're in the medical corps." I said, "I don't want to be in the medical corps. I don't want to be a medic. I don't want to be with blood. I don't like people that are around me who are sick and all that kind of stuff."
Right.
They said, "Adrian, you're in the medical corps." They sent me to Farragut, Idaho, where they had training, and for about 6 to 8 weeks, I was trained in first aid, in effect, and with a handbook of hospital corps, which is what they called it. And then that was all the training I had. I spent the rest of my time in the Navy in good duty, not war duty at all. I believe the war was still going on, but I was at Northwestern University decommissioning the B-12 base. The war ended. I was discharged. As I said, I joined the Navy Reserve, and that's how I got to the Korean situation.
Oh, okay. Again, to remind our audience all the corpsmen that take care of the Marine Corps or Navy corpsmen, correct?
Yeah, right. The Marine Corps has no medical.
Mm-hmm.
So any medical in the Marine Corps are doctors, corpsmen, whatever. That's basically it. So the Navy provides the medical for the Marine Corps.
Okay. We were talking with Leonard Adrian, whose newest book is called Hilltop Doc, and it's about his experiences in Korea. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600 in southeastern Michigan. That's 734-822-1600. Or if you want to give us a call toll-free, you can at 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. Leonard, when you shipped out for Korea, what did you know about Korea?
Oh, I only knew what the drill instructor at Camp Pam Pendleton had told us. He had already been to Korea. He had shrapnel in his left leg, and he had been treated by Corman, and he was very high on what Corman did for him. Mm-hmm. And then he described in the pre-Korean training what Korea was like, the hills, the valleys, the hilltops, the mortars, the burp guns, the flying shrapnel, all of that. And so we had a pretty good idea of what the hilltop, hillside fighting in Korea was going to be all about. And when I got there, the fighting had gone all the way up the peninsula, down the peninsula, through the Chosin Reservoir, which was a very tough thing for the Marines, and then finally settled at the 38th parallel. And it was a war, according to the guys that talked to us, where we were not going to take territory. We were going to hold our ground. We were going to hold the high ground at the 38th and try to keep the Chinese from taking it from us. And we were going up and down and up and down these hills, trying to hold the ground. And that went on the entire time I was there. And in fact, it went on until July of 1953.
Right.
So that was the war at that point in time.
That was taking the same hills over and over again.
Yeah, that was really sad. And we were very frustrated to do that. But the Chinese were very relentless in their attacks on us. They were almost suicidal in that no matter how many we seemed to kill, there were always more Chinese coming and coming and coming. Of course, they have a huge population and they had a huge army.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was frustrating to take a hill, dig in at the top of the hill, hold the hill, and then finally, ultimately, they would counterattack us, and with greater numbers than we could supply, they would push us off the hill, and then we would reconnoiter and come back, and we'd take the same hill again at great cost to us in casualty.
Sure.
And at great cost to them as well.
Wow. Well, you were kind of an unusual medic, if I can remember. In reading your story, my experience with medics when I was in Vietnam, that most of them were not heavily armed, but you seemed to pick up a little arsenal of your own as you were over, the longer you were there. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can. We were issued M1 carbines, and my carbine had a curved, whatever you call that thing, you stick in the carbine, clip,
okay.
And it would shoot 30 rounds. And that was good, except it wasn't very accurate. While I was in Korea, one time I was crawling up a hill with the Marines. We went in fire teams, and we were going after the top of the hill. And the call came, Corman. And when the call comes, Corman, you go to where the call came from. So I ran to the place where, in a little gully, there was a corporal and a Marine that was face down in the mud there. It was a very wet day, as I recall it. And the corporal and I turned over the wounded Marine. And as soon as I saw him, I knew we were too late, because you see that fixed stare of death. Mm-hmm. And he was covered in blood. And I tried for a pulse, but there was no pulse. And the corporal who was there unleashed his belt, his web belt, and he gave it to me, which had a 45 on it, along with a bunch of bullets for the 45. And he said, here, you take this. You can use this. And by the time I turned to tell him that he ought to take it, because I don't really carry a 45, he was gone. And so I had a 45. Later, in the fighting on the hilltop, sides. When we got near the machine gun nests, when we're trying to take a hill, and you had to take those machine guns out in order to get past them, get to the top, the Marines found out that because I had pitched in baseball as a younger person, and I was still pretty young, I was 24 years old in Korea, I could throw a grenade further than some of them, and I could throw it more accurately than some of them. So they gave me grenades, and I learned how to throw those grenades very well. And that helped in the assault on the embankment where the machine gunners were. So, yes, I was a pretty well-armed corpsman because I was with my M1, I was with my 45, and I had grenades on my belt. And that is a little unusual. Most of the corpsmen did not have all that.
I didn't think so. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview even that you were helicoptered in to Korea, and I wasn't that familiar with helicopters being in Korea. Could you tell me about the type that were there? Were they the ones that were on MASH, or were they bananas?
You know, I don't know what was on MASH, because when I saw the first or one or two shows of MASH, I didn't like the show. I thought mm-hmm. it made Korea and the field hospital, that was an Army field hospital, MASH was, it was a little bit frivolous for me. It was a little bit too light, and it wasn't very light at a field hospital, at least at my experience there. So I didn't watch MASH, but we had the large helicopters, I don't know what they were called anymore, and the Bell helicopters as well. And when I got to Korea, we landed at Busan. I was on a ship called the General Meigs. Mm-hmm. About 5,500 of us were landed at Busan. And we were taken by trucks to an airfield near Busan. And that airfield was amazingly covered by helicopter after helicopter mm-hmm. after helicopter. And all of us that were assigned to the 38th parallel were put on these large helicopters, and we were flown up to a airport, airfield near a little town called Inje, and there we were taken off the helicopters and put on trucks to go to wherever our battalion base was going to be. And I'll tell you, that helicopter ride at the first arrival in Korea to me was pretty scary, because the first thing that happened on the helicopter was some guy came around and he gave us a parachute. And then he showed us how to use the parachute, and he put the parachute on us. And he said, when you jump, this is what you do. And when you hit the ground, this is what you do. And I didn't like the word when at all.
No, I wouldn't think so. And normally they don't give you a helicopter give you a parachute on a helicopter, because you jump out and the blades come down, it doesn't work well.
I don't know if it worked well or not, but fortunately we didn't jump. And they flew low over the Korean landscape. And for the first time, I saw Korean villages. I saw rice paddies. I saw what it was like. But we made it okay. But there's a lot of helicopters in Korea. And the Bellcopter, which is the one I'm most familiar with, was the one that we used to carry the wounded.
Right.
From the battalion base, but we call it a battalion aid station. If we couldn't handle the wounded at the battalion aid station, which is a few miles south of the 38th parallel, then we would either helicopter them, or we would take an ambulance or a jeep and drive them to the field hospital, which was, again, a few more miles south. And if that didn't work, they would be taken by helicopter to the hospital ship, which was off the south coast of Korea. So helicopters were widely used in Korea.
It's funny. I mean, not funny, but I mean, I flew helicopters in Vietnam, and I was not aware of the history of them. And I was just looking at on my computer of the different types of helicopters that were in Korea, and some of them look a little ancient, that's for sure, but I'm sure that they were effective.
Well, they were. The one we were in, the first one, the big one,
yep.
was leaky. The air was pouring in from different directions. It was noisy. I didn't feel very secure in that helicopter. Smaller helicopters that were used to carry the wounded, I thought were much better in terms mm-hmm. of being more solid.
Right. That was their mission, I think, at that point. We've got a couple of minutes, Leonard, before we get to the bottom of the hour and take a news break. Tell me about what did you carry? What was in your medical kit that you carried with you?
It was pretty full. We had the important things, I think, were the charrettes, which were little syringes that we used or preloaded with morphine.
Oh, okay.
A lot of bandages, because the corpsman's job on the hillside, when we got to a wounded, when I, the first guy I treated who was wounded on the hillside, I don't mean the lieutenant who died, but the, his gut was open, there was a lot of blood coming out, and my job was, number one, I had to slow him down because he was gyrating around and twisting and yelling, and I couldn't handle him that way, so I gave him a shot of morphine. It calmed him down. He quieted enough so I could get his jacket and everything off. I found the wound, and then I would take bandages, and I would press the bandages hard against the wound because we had to stop the bleeding.
Right.
Because that was the most dangerous thing for anybody that was wounded is the to
okay.
bleed out.
I got to cut in here for just a second. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after the news. We can hear the band there. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with our guest, Leonard Adrian, who is author of a new book entitled Hilltop Doc, at the Marine Corpsman Fighting Through the Mud and Blood of the Korean War. And we're trying to draw attention to the Korean War because of some of the things that are going on in the news, but also because of the 36,000-plus men and women who died in Korea. And we want to make sure that we never forget them either. Leonard, when you know, so many books are that talk about war never get into the nitty-gritty of what it actually is like. And when I was reading your book, we were there with you. And I'd like you to kind of describe, if you can, what it was like trying to save some of these young men.
Sure, I'll give it a try. Every circumstance, of course, was unique, but as I told you before the break, in the rush of battle, while we're on the way up a hill, and if somebody was injured, the first thing we tried to do was to stabilize the situation by stopping the bleeding and to control the pain, which would also control the gyration of the body, which would help him begin to heal. We did much more when we were stationed at the field hospital, which we called Easy Med, because there was a real hospital with doctors and surgery and all that going on, including even psychiatric treatment for the Marines that were in trouble in that war. I had situations that I couldn't handle. We had a situation where the Marine was lying on the ground. He was turning all kinds of colors. My other corpsman, who was more experienced than I was, say, he needs a tracheotomy. Give him a tracheotomy.
Oy.
And I wasn't trained to give him a tracheotomy, but we carried a scalpel in our med kit. And Sammy, who was my friend, jumped in and said, hey, I can do this. And so Sammy gave him a tracheotomy, and he wanted to know if I had a pen. Now, I didn't know what he wanted with a pen, but I did have a pen. I gave him the pen. He said, the pen will do it. And I think there's a chapter in the book, so it's got a pen.
Right.
And he used the pen to hold the opening open until the doctor could be summoned, and he could come in and put a tube in there so the guy could breathe. And I'm sure the Marine survived, and it only survived because of what Sammy was able to do. And I was not up to that. I just didn't feel comfortable doing it. And we were not trained all those years ago, really, in camp in Farragut, Idaho, to know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy guys were not trained in tracheotomies and all, and I wasn't trained when in the pre-Korean training. And it hadn't come up because the training I got in Korea was basically from my doc, whose name was Doc Kaz. We called him Kaz. I think his name was Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. And the other corpsman like Sammy, who was the second tour of duty and had experienced a lot more than I have. So we got good training in Korea, but on the job training and the tracheotomy thing was tough.
I can't imagine that. When I was reading that in your book, and you were talking about the idea of using the tube from a pen, you know, a ballpoint pen, as the tube, so that they could breathe, it gave me goosebumps to think about it. But thank goodness that you were there, and thanks goodness that that Sammy was there, and you were able to save this Marine's life.
Thank goodness is right.
Wow, I think when you mentioned all the times that you were going up and down these hills, and getting involved in all of the battles, I can only imagine how frustrating that must have been to you.
Yeah, it was tough because we didn't seem to be getting anywhere. We take a hill, we lose a hill, we take a hill, and the war was stagnant at that point, but we were losing a lot of men. And, excuse me, and that is really a tough thing to see. We had 103,000 wounded in the Korean War in only 37 months. As you pointed out before, with 36,000 died, 8,000 are still listed as missing in action. It was a very intense war, and the casualty rate at about 4,000 a month is very high. And so we had our hands full.
You certainly did. You mentioned in the book too that you also felt that at some points it didn't seem like that the politicians knew what they were doing.
Well, that goes way back.
Yeah, I know.
It started at Potsdam when Churchill and Truman and Stalin were there, and they decided that the Korean Peninsula should be divided at the 38th parallel. They didn't decide the 38th parallel, but they decided it should be divided, and the north part of it would go to communist control with the Soviet Union, and the south part would go to the United States control, which would be more democratic. That's where it all began. Mm-hmm. And later they decided that the 38th parallel would be the dividing point, and of course they created two Koreas, and then the Soviet Union's created the Korea that was finally under the grandfather of Kim Jong-un. And you know what happened then? Mm-hmm. He wanted to take out South Korea, and he invaded South Korea, and that's what started the whole thing. And the sad part of it was, I think it was in June or July of 1951, when I was there, that talks began at Panmunjom, and it took them until July 27th of 1953 before they finally reached a ceasefire. They never reached a peace agreement. They only reached a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And that's the status of it now. And, of course, the present leader of North Korea wants to take all of South Korea and make it his territory still. And that's a really bad situation. And the other thing that happened there, which was disturbing to all of us, was that General MacArthur convinced Harry Truman that the Chinese would not enter the war. Mm-hmm. MacArthur did a good job of coming into the war and beating the North Koreans, and they were at Pyongyang, and they were about to end the war. And the Chinese had warned MacArthur not to cross the 38th parallel. And mm-hmm. MacArthur decided the Chinese were bluffing, and he met with Truman on, I think it was Midway Island, and Truman asked him, are the Chinese going to come into this war? And MacArthur said no. And Truman gave him the okay to go ahead north of the 38th parallel. And that precipitated the Chinese coming into the war, and that changed the whole dynamic of it.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, considering the hundreds of thousands of troops that the Chinese had and still have, but, against, I don't know how many Allied troops were in South Korea. Do you have an idea or a ballpark figure of how many of you were there?
At one time, no, I don't know. I think that at the last part of the book, there's a little history of Korea and how many mm-hmm. people served there. But I don't know how many served there at any one particular time.
You know, I was wondering, you know, so, sort of like Vietnam, there were at one point you had 400,000 there, but really only about 2.5-3 million people ever served there. And so, you know, and then you know, how many hundreds of thousands of Chinese came down, you know?
Oh, yeah, we were very much outnumbered by the Chinese, and I wasn't that close in, but when the Chinese came in November, and they had a horrible winter that winter, they had surrounded the Marine Corps, which was at the Chosin Basin, and it was a really horrendous thing. A great tribute to the Marines because they finally fought their way out of there against great odds and against great numbers. And actually, when I was there at the 38th parallel, we were mostly outnumbered by the Chinese. Whenever they decided they were going to come at us and take us off a hill or keep us from getting up the hill, we didn't. Every hill we went up, we didn't make it. But we, you know, it was very, very tough stuff.
It's always amazing how they're able to convince us as soldiers, Marines, and so forth that, you know, take that hill and we do everything possible to take a hill, and then we'll do it again. Now, if we look, of course, looking back on it now, we're going, nah, let's think about this a little bit, right?
Yeah. No, I think we had to take the hills because otherwise, from the top of the hills, the Chinese would control all of the transportation. The main service road that ran below the hill, they could just lob the hell out of that road and kill anybody that was in a convoy there. And so it was very important to take the high ground. We understood that, and we weren't frustrated that we were ordered to go up a hill. We were ordered to go up a hill in snow, in ice, in rain. In terrible conditions.
I was just going to ask you about the weather while you were there. I have heard stories from other Korean veterans about how cold it was, and you know the weather just seems to be awful.
Yeah, it was tough weather because in the summertime it was very hot and humid and full of mosquitoes and very unpleasant in that way. We couldn't get cool. But in the wintertime, which is even worse, there was a lot of snow and ice. We were in the hilltops, of course, and the temperatures would plummet well below zero. The first winter, though, I didn't experience because that was the first winter that the war occurred, the winter of 50 and 51. Then the temperatures went down, as far as I could tell, according to what the people told me there, 25 below zero. And the Marines were not equipped for that kind of weather. MacArthur didn't know that was the situation, apparently, because they had the wrong socks and a lot of frostbite and a lot of damage that way. The winter I was there, which was 51-52, was not that severe, but I was not in the Chosin Reservoir area either. So the 38th parallel was not as high and not as difficult. So it wasn't as cold. But it was cold.
I can only imagine. I mean, I talked to a gentleman here in our local area who was there at the Chosin Reservoir, and he just said he couldn't stop shivering for years after he got home.
No, that was very, very bad. Yeah. Very, very sad.
Which I can certainly understand. Well, what made you decide to write your story, Leonard?
Well, when I was given orders to leave Korea, I was told I had to report to Maison, which is the 1st Marine Division headquarters, and I had 36 hours to report. And I was at the helicopter pad because they were going to helicopter me down to K-10 Airfield, which is near Maison. I didn't know why I got orders, and nobody could tell me that. And I didn't know I was going to be reassigned. I knew that. So anyway, my platoon guys joined me at the helicopter pad, which was an old rice paddy at one time, and they wanted to say goodbye. And we all talked about the future, and we decided that we were not going to relive our reunion about what happened in Korea, that it was the kind of thing that we should simply try to put behind us and move on with our lives. And so it was a real goodbye. We didn't exchange names, addresses, phone numbers, anything. We said, this is goodbye. We're never going to see each other again. The helicopter took off. I saw my guys, all my buddies waving at me. That's the last I've seen of them. And I went down to the south part of Korea to get reassigned. And so that was, so that's, when I got home in 1952, my mother, my father, my brother wanted to know all about what happened in Korea because I didn't write much about it. And I told them we're not going to talk about it. I'm going into the future now. And they respected that, and they were glad I was home and I was okay. And the next year, I married my wife, Audrey, and Audrey knew I had been to Korea, and she knew I wouldn't want to, I didn't want to talk about it, and she never asked me a question about it. And for more than 60 years, not one word was said to anybody what happened.
Oh.
But I was volunteering to facilitate writing classes at the Lifelong Learning Program at Washington U, and a friend of mine, Dick Hyde, knew that I'd been there, and he was facilitating a class on the Korean War, so he asked me if I would appear before his class just to answer a few questions, 15, 20 minutes. So I went over to his class, and I said, I'll give it a try, Dick. And the class had a million questions. They want to know every detail of what happened there. And 15 to 20 minutes became an hour, then 2 hours, then 3 or 4 hours. I went back multiple times, and I found out something amazing. My memory was crisp and clear and vivid about everything that happened more than 60 years ago. And then the faculty there said, you got to write some of this down. So I wrote some little vignettes about what happened on this day or on that day, and they wanted me to share it with my memoir class. And I started to do that, and finally the faculty came to me and said, you've got to make it into a book. And that's when I began to think about making it into a book, and I resisted that. I didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some things I didn't want to write about.
Sure.
And they insisted because they said that they thought it's time for a book that is realistic about what war is really like, not a Hollywood movie version of heroics and drama, but what war is really like. And then I thought about the 36,000 and the 104,000 and the 8,000 that are missing, and I said, you know, I should write a book for them. And I dedicated the book to those who died and were injured in Korea.
That's
how I happened to write a book.
Well, it's a great story, and I think the book is a great read for people who want to know what happened in Korea and what was going on over there. And as I said earlier on, you've become sort of an advocate now talking about Korea and that you don't want to see it happen again. And I happen to find a number of articles that you've gotten. You've been very busy, Leonard. Some articles that you have written recently about that we cannot make the same mistake in Korea. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, I feel very strongly that we should not save South Korea again in another bloody war on that peninsula. That South Korea, with 50 million people, should be able to and must be encouraged to develop military capability so that they can save themselves. After all, they're against, they're a prosperous nation, and they're against a nation of 25 million people, North Korea, and most of those 25 million are very impoverished. Although they have spent all of their money all these years developing a very strong military, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the president of our country needs to tell the President Moon of South Korea that he has to be responsible for his own safety, and he should develop the capability of protecting himself, even winning a war against North Korea. And we have 28,000 troops there. Those troops are sitting ducks
right.
for what Kim Jong-un may want to do. And it's very disturbing to me that they are there as a deterrent on the theory that the North Koreans will not attack because if they kill American troops, America will retaliate, and that would be pretty devastating for the North Koreans. So that deterrent probably has run its course. And so I advocate that we provide tanks and weapons and planes and missiles or whatever is needed and some training and put Korea, South Korea, in a position where they can beat North Korea, and then we take our troops out of there. The sad thing about it is I just found out that the United States is building an $11 billion new base in South Korea, and it's going to be occupied by about 45,000 Americans, family, children, and military people. And all those people will be assembled in one place, which makes them an incredibly serious target.
Right, it certainly does.
For Kim or anybody else that wants to target them, and I think that's a crime. Shouldn't happen, but it is happening, and I don't think anybody's listening to my approach. People have felt that if we withdrew from Korea, that would invite Kim to attack, and I think there's merit to that point of view. So I'm not saying we should withdraw now. We should withdraw after we have put South Korea in a position where they can protect themselves.
And
I hope that that's what happens, but I'm not certain that's going to happen. It's not going that way right now.
It's kind of surprising to when you think about it, because the Republic of Korea fighters that I experienced, you know, that I served with in Vietnam were notorious for being the toughest, the strongest, the most courageous, and, you know, nothing deterred them at all. And that I'm sure that the South Vietnamese or the South Korean army probably is strong, but I don't know how big it is. And
last I read, it was about 1,100,000 troops compared to the South Koreans, which I think have about 600,000 troops. Don't hold me to the numbers exactly, but it's in that range, and that's a serious deficit.
It is. It is. Considering that the economy of South Korea, you think that they could afford to...
They can't afford, and the North Koreans cannot. But North Korea has been putting all of their money into their military and their weapons, and of course we know that they're hopped into a intercontinental missile and a nuclear warhead, which makes them worldwide very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something has to be done about that, and I think it has to be done very quickly. China seems not to want to cause North Korea to give up its nuclear and intercontinental missile program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why. And China's in a position where they could guarantee to North Korea, who says they're afraid they'll be attacked unless they have all these intercontinental missiles, that China could say, like we did before in 1950, we could save you again if somebody attacks you.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the power, and we've got the manpower, and it would be true. And there's nothing wrong with China doing that, except they haven't done it. And I don't know that our president, with his new relationship with President Moon the president of China, has been able to get that message across. If that doesn't happen, I think the world has to do something to get regime change in North Korea, because this guy is unpredictable and he's extraordinarily dangerous.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more.
It would be great if he could do that with an internal coup kind of thing. And if they can't do that, I think a coalition of nations like Australia, Japan, the United States, all of us vulnerable nations, are going to have to take him out. If he reaches the point, according to our intelligence, that he can pull the trigger and send a missile to hit Hawaii or Japan or Australia or the coast of the United States. And the last information was he's already bragged that he could hit anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, I saw that. He thinks he could get to Chicago.
If it's true, and if we verify that he can do that, action has to be taken. We can't let him be in a position where he can pull that trigger. And that's why I'm feeling a great sense of urgency about this. But I may be the only person in America.
I don't think you are. We're talking here with Leonard Adrian here about his new book, Hilltop Doc, and his experiences in Korea when he was a medic. with the Marines, and I think it's just so important to get your perspective on what you went through 60 some odd years ago, and that things unfortunately really haven't changed that much in that 60-year time period. And I admire you very much for, you know, having the courage not only to write the book, but to write some of the editorials that you've been sending out. So I encourage you, keep it up, Leonard. We need people like you out there.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
We got about 2 minutes. So if everybody wants to buy the book, and I encourage them to do the Hilltop Doc, where would they go?
They can go to my website, which is hilltopdoc.com.
Okay.
And that will lead them to Amazon, or link them up to Book Baby, or link them up to Barnes & Noble. All of those places are selling the book.
Okay. We will do that. And I think it's, again, Leonard's last name is spelled A-D, which I just misplaced it.
A-D-R-E-O-N.
A-D-R-E-O-N. And I think if you plug that into Google, you might find some of the articles that we were talking about as well. So I encourage our listeners to do this. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. Leonard, it was a privilege and an honor to talk to you, and I wish you the best.
Thanks, Dale. I appreciate your calling me, and it was good to be on Veterans Radio.
Thank you. We'll be talking to you soon. If you have anything you want us to do, let us know.
Okay, I will.
All righty. Thank you very much. All right, that's another show is in the proverbial can, as they say. And we will be back next week. We're going to be talking to a flight surgeon next week that was in Vietnam with the Air Force, the United States Air Force, and he's going to be talking about his experiences in Vietnam. So I want to make sure that you do that. And I'm trying to think of other things that are coming up. Don't forget about the Yankee Air Museum, Thunder over Michigan. That will be coming up for Labor Day weekend. Veterans Radio will be there. And listen, you know, for those of you that are listening, if you have story ideas or you want to tell a story on Veterans Radio, just go to our website, veteransradio.net, click on the contact, and we'll get you on the program. So until next week, you are dismissed.